Last time, I tried to make clear, as best I could, in an introduction to liberalism, the basis of liberalism, which is, of course, the Enlightenment, very largely, the quest towards a state of laws, which you had in Hegel, reflected in Hegel, the quest for constitutions, because the basic problem of liberalism was always to reconcile, on the one hand, the individual, and on the other hand, the community, so that we might say that liberalism has the same thrust as many other theories, including Hegel, namely to reconcile the new quest for self and self-consciousness of the Enlightenment and French Revolution, the wars of liberation, and all of that. And on the other hand, what is also inherent in these major historical events, the longing for community. And liberalism stresses, if you like, as I tried to make clear last time, to be sure, the individual, and perhaps better, individual freedom. But the stress on individual freedom, which I tried to illustrate through Mills on liberty, that stress on individual freedom, of course, raises the problem of how such individual freedom, freedom of speech and thought, can be reconciled with the community. How there has to be some kind of authority that has to keep order. The state, as I said last time, to be sure, as the night watchman. But still, what is the night watchman to do? And John Stuart Mill solved it by saying what he is to do. He is to interfere only if a person takes action against another. Remember the example that John Stuart Mill said. It's all right to agitate against corn dealers, but once you incite the mob to storm corn dealers' houses, or once you yourself take physical action against corn dealers, it's another matter. So that you can see in John Stuart Mill, and I ended with that last time, also the kind of fear of the mob which you have here, and which eventually becomes, if you like, a kind of concern about the working classes. Though first, under the influence of the French Revolution, it is a fear of the mob. From that again, it follows that you can see quite clearly that the middle classes, whose theory that it was, defined themselves against the aristocracy, against the monarchy, in their idea of freedom and in their idea of equality, against what I said last time, the Ancien Régime, but that they also had the problem of defining themselves against the mob. So that liberalism becomes bound up very squarely with the quest for self-identification of the middle classes. And that is very basic for everything that will now follow. The quest for self-identification of the middle classes against the aristocracy and the monarchy. They sympathize with the French Revolution. You can go further than that. You can say that the beginning of the French Revolution, the Constitution of 1791, before the Jacobins, is in fact a charter for all future constitutions in Europe, because it will try to make a balance between law and individual freedom. It will abolish feudal privilege, that is to say, aristocratic privilege. It will tie the hand of a king or transform the king into a constitutional monarch. All of that is involved here in the liberal opposition against the ancien regime, at the same time that you have the fear of the mob. So you might bear that in mind. And I want to say one thing now, to which I will come back. The basic way in which the middle class will try to define itself against the aristocracy and against, if you like, eventually the working classes is through constitutions. Through constitutions, and of course, through laws, but also through the concept of respectability. That is to say, when you read Tom Brown's School Days, whose morality, as you will see, will become the morality of society as a whole, that kind of morality was first a way for the middle classes to define and distinguish themselves through their so-called respectability from the loose-living aristocracy. Don't forget, the loose-living aristocracy and the immoral mob. And you get this idea in Tom Brown, and you get it in Rudyard Kipling, you know, and in all sorts of people later, that the middle classes are the models for society, and that they are the models against what is assumed, that the aristocracy is immoral and that the working classes are immoral. That's assumed, of course, far from the truth again. It becomes a myth, yes? But it's a necessary myth, because it's a myth that enables the middle classes to self-define themselves. Respectability, our modern manners and morals, are a means of self-definition. And therefore, those whom we think menacing, whether in class terms or in other terms, because eventually you can put it on the blacks, on the Jews, or on the working classes, it doesn't really matter. They always lack respectability. So that one way of the middle classes to emphasize their freedom, if you like, freedom of thought and freedom of expression, and to make a kind of wall around that freedom, if you like, protect it, protect all of this from onslaughts, from above and below, was, of course, by making laws and constitutions. That is clear. And so these constitutions and these laws have two things built in, always. First of all, a property franchise for voting. That is to say, against the lower classes, against the mob. You had to have so much property to exercise the vote, to participate, yes? And, of course, to limit the power of the monarchy, and thereby, of course, and abolish feudalism, abolish feudal estates, abolish all parts of feudalism, feudal ideas of property and things of that nature. So the constitution-making here enshrines, as it were, also middle-class self-identification against the aristocracy and against below. And you can see that in the constitutions that were made in France after, but not only in France, all over Europe. But you can see it another way. And I want to combine that in this idea of morals and manners, which is inseparable from constitutions and laws, in that new idea of respectability, which we have already discussed from another angle here, how it grew up. But the middle classes adopted the pietistic, as you will see, and evangelical ideas as another idea of self-definition. First, against the aristocracy, loose living, and then against the lower classes as well, loose living, drink, You can just think of the cartoons of Rawlinson in England of the drunk lower classes. What is it? Gin for a penny, or things of this nature. You have, therefore, here, again, respectability. Now, this idea of respectability, however, and I say it now because you must now read Tom Brown's School Days, becomes, of course, generalized. It becomes, again, a myth. It's not true that the lower classes are sexually promiscuous. The contrary is, by and large, the truth of working classes eventually, nor is, of course, the myth of the aristocracy true. But it becomes so strong a matter of self-definition of the middle classes that eventually all outsiders are included. And so you get, as a mark of the outsider, you know, the black, after all, in racism, the black is sexually promiscuous, sexually to be feared. It's always painted that way. And the Jew is sexually to be feared. He knows nothing but lust. In other words, these outsiders become the models of unrespectability. And I dare say they still are. They still are. Because manners and morals, ever since that time, have become a means of self-identification. That must be clear to you as much as laws and constitutions. And therefore, as these are means of self-identification, what you have, therefore, here is what is first a middle-class idea, then spreading to all of society. Respectability is eventually adopted by everybody. And not only that, eventually, of course, property qualifications are dropped from the franchise, and everybody is taken in to laws and constitutions as well. So what starts out as a middle-class quest toward self-esteem and self-definition becomes dominant by the middle of the 19th century for all of society. But it is a phenomena which must be familiar to you, that respectability and self-righteousness go together. And they just don't go together because of religious bias, the basis. They may also, but the basis of self-definition. The pride in respectability that you get still today, today I shouldn't say, perhaps, the pride in respectability that you got is, I think, here extremely important. Now, both constitutions and this idea of respectability, we're supposed to solve also one of the main problems inherent, if you like, in liberalism. That is to reconcile the individual and the community. Now, this reconciliation of individualism and the community could be done through laws and constitutions. That's clear. Respectability, through giving a kind of conformity, quite contrary to all the freedom. We shall see, a kind of paradox again, something that doesn't rhyme in liberalism, that there is, let us say, conformity on the level of manners and morals, in spite of the emphasis on freedom of thought and freedom of expression and all of this. This kind of paradox in liberalism, again, is supposed to solve the idea of the individual and society, to produce, as it were, the idea of harmony, harmony. Because otherwise, the free play of individuals might go into chaos. The world might become a dog-eat-dog world. And that, of course, had to be avoided. That, of course, liberalism didn't want either. So that you always have these ideas. Now, they could lead to all sorts of things. Mill's idea of harmonizing it were laws and constitutions and manners and morals. He wrote a famous book on that, a book about women, manners and morals as well. But another famous way of doing it was by a man whom you've all heard of, Tocqueville, famous liberal, after all, Tocqueville, who went to Christianity. He was an atheist. He didn't believe in Christianity. But he was in such a despair, in a way, of reconciling individualism in the community, and his experience in the French Parliament didn't make him any more optimistic about this, that in the end he went, as it were, to Christianity as the cement, though he was, after all, an unbeliever. But that wasn't usually the cement of liberalism, because liberals believed necessarily in the separation of church and state. Remember what I read to you about Mill, that was basic, because separation of church and state means freedom of thought and freedom of expression. And here I must say something else that isn't clear to you who live in a secular age, when Christianity is no longer an issue, really, that for liberals and eventually for young Hegelians and Marx, the enemy was Christianity. When they thought of the enemy, it was Christianity. The enemy of freedom of thought was Christianity. So they all fought against the church. And of course, this was an heritage from the Enlightenment, that Christianity had to be defeated, because Christianity was the enemy of the freedoms in which liberalism believed, the freedoms in which the young Hegelians believed, and in which, of course, Karl Marx eventually believed. Christianity was the enemy. So de Tocqueville's going to Christianity is, of course, something quite exceptional indeed. Now, this idea of harmony that I've talked about was aggravated for liberals, not only by the competition on which it was based, between individuals and interests, if you like. It was also aggravated by their idea of the progression of history. Then history is progress. But for liberalism, history was not progress in the Hegelian sense. That is to say, history was not a dialectic. But history was a straight line. There is in liberalism none of Hegel's ideas that happiness is not the end of history. All these things we talked about, that in order to get on in history, you have to, as it were, bear tyrants and all of that sort of thing. And Napoleon was a tool of the cunning of history, and so was Caesar. Of course, liberalism rejected all tyrants. There was none of this dialectic in liberalism. It was a straight line. Now, this made for a theoretical difficulty of some importance. Because liberals believed, and here again John Stuart Mill is very important in this, that progress of history is based on freedom, free speech, free debate. That the maximum of personal freedom means the maximum of progress. And here you get John Stuart Mill's famous idea that freedom of speech and freedom of debate will bring out progress, will make progress. And it is a unilateral progress, because John Stuart Mill attacks very harshly those who do not believe in this kind of linear progress. There are some, he says, and again I quote, as always, from On Liberty. There are some, he says, who will infer that savage life is preferable to civilized, that the work of civilization should as far as possible be undone. And from the premise of Rousseau, he will not improbably be led to the practical conclusion of Rousseau's disciple, Robespierre. Now, you know what he's saying. He says progress is necessary, We must accept the Industrial Revolution. That's really what he says. Progress is necessary, and history is progress. And therefore, if we go back to savagery with Robespierre, we end up at the guillotine. We end up with if we go back to the primitive man with Rousseau, we end up with Robespierre. In other words, because Robespierre, he believed, and the Jacobins were based on Rousseau in turning civilization back, as he thought, yes? Therefore, you end up with the guillotine, you end up in savagery. Mill was not enamored of the French Revolution, of the Jacobins. So you end up in savagery. As you will sow, you will reap, and you'll end up, therefore, in savagery. So there is here no nostalgia. It isn't enlightenment in this sense, and be careful about that. It isn't the enlightenment in the sense of Rousseau at all. It is the enlightenment in the sense of progress. Unremitting progress. Unremitting unilineal progress. Brought about, as I said, by free debate. Now again, you might say, why? Why was Mill so sure that free debate would bring about progress, that this was the engine of progress, the technique of progress, the strategy of progress? Well, the answer is very simple, because Mill believed in reason, in human reason. And here he was again of the Enlightenment, that in free debate, human reason will triumph, because he believed, and liberalism basically believed, in the rationality of man. That's what I told you last time. That is what liberalism has in common with socialism and Marxism, and not with conservatism. That it believed in rationalism, in the rationalism of man. The rationalism of man. But that didn't mean civilization had to be undone to start from the beginning with Emile in Rousseau. On the contrary, civilization goes on. But the quest is still, this idea of reason did mean, and that is important, a certain elitism. Because Mill was now in a bind. If free debate and free speech is the engine of progress of history, to be sure it makes a very great problem about individuality in the community, yes? Can then everybody take part? What about then? I mean, Mill was no fool. I mean, he saw that not everybody had reason. These people were idiots. They saw around. They saw most people didn't have reason. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? So in the end, quite logically, Mill ends with a kind of elitism. With a kind of elitism. Let me again from On Liberty I'll lead you to the passage on the elitism, yes? The power of the majority is salutary insofar as it used defensively, not offensively, as its exertion is tempered by respect for personality of the individual and deference to superiority of cultivated intelligence. In other words, he solved the problem by fusing the idea of the majority with the idea of the state. The majority is good, but only negatively. Only negatively. It must be restrained by constitutions and laws, only negatively, in some vague way. But what is important are cultivated intelligence. For the truth is that liberalism, in spite of its democratic impulse, if you want to put it that way, could not do without an elite. That in the end, because of its idea of free debate and the idea of the way history progresses, liberalism could not do without it. And therefore, within liberalism, another 18th century idea becomes crucial, the idea of education. It continued because it needed the elite. I hope you see how it comes about. The emphasis on education. Because if the engine of progress, because if there is no cunning of reason, if there is no independent history, as with Hegel, independent rhythm of history, as with Hegel, if everything is really carried on the shoulders of the individual, and if progress is due to debate among individuals, freedom of debate, if every individual has his right to a wrong opinion, still underlying it that there is a right opinion, which will come out in this freedom of debate. Freedom of debate, in other words, isn't wide open in Mill or liberalism. Freedom of thought is not wide open. If it were, there could be no progress, because who would win? You wouldn't know what is the truth. And none of these theories abandoned ideas of truth, no more than Marx did liberalism abandon idea of truth. There is a basic idea of truth, and that basic idea of truth is reason. So there is a preconception, and the debate must be shaped, if I can put it out, in spite of the rhetoric, so that reason will win, whatever that means. And whatever that means is that you have to have an educated debate. You have to have education, because the majority, they realize, was not informed with reason. It has to be educated. We'll come back to that. And therefore, liberals instituted adult education movements. We'll come back to that. We'll see about that. Education movement. Now, for that reason, I must therefore add a third pillar to constitutionalism, let us call laws and constitutions, constitutionalism and respectability as a way of solving the harmony between the individual and society, or building bridges, if you like, or integrating the individual with society. Two, constitutionalism and respectability, therefore, to these two bridges, we must add a third bridge, the belief in reason. In reason and progress, a typically 18th century idea, the belief in reason and progress, that the idea that reason will in the end win. And therefore you now get a rhetoric you don't get before, but which is again so familiar to you, that this will be a consensus among reasonable people. I mean, you've heard that, haven't you? Reasonable people will come to this consensus, or you've never been to faculty meeting. Reasonable people will come to the consensus. But of course, as there are no such things as reasonable people, what people really mean is that my opinion will prevail. Because what is reason here? What is reason here? Well, reason is defined, of course, as the liberal ideal. That is to say, reason is a self-definition. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you ask what is reason, a reason is, I suppose, a kind of logic. And if you really want to say what is reason, you can say perhaps fairer, it is still a belief in the natural laws. It is still a belief in the natural laws of the 18th century. Yes, very much so, very much so. Because that will coincide with liberal interest. After all, it was an English liberal, Cobden said, you might as well regulate the relations between employer and laborer as the seasons, you see, because all of this is, after all, self-regulatory. So you believe in the natural laws. You believe in the natural laws and that you shouldn't interfere with these natural laws, and that therefore you shouldn't make laws about labor relations or anything like that, or economics. And again, why? Because the natural laws are reasonable. Therefore, as it were, reason will win. In other words, if you interfere with the natural law, and I remind you of this, you probably have forgotten it since we discussed it in the 18th century. The natural law comes from God, after all. Therefore, if you interfere with the natural laws, you're interfering with the harmony of God's universe. But if you do not interfere with the natural laws, then here, as in debate, an underlying harmony will prevail. Therefore, you must not interfere with economics. And therefore, you must not interfere with the relations between employer and laborer. You mustn't have trade unions, and you mustn't have these kind of laws. Because you must not interfere with economic laws, because they will become harmonious. They are reasonable, because God would not make anything unreasonable, and human interference will only make them unreasonable. This is a very good Enlightenment theory applied to economics, but of course coinciding in a very neat way with the beginning of modern capitalism and with liberal self-interest. Similarly, as liberals would say, that the laws of respectability are inherent moral laws, as the 18th century said to a certain degree, and also become part of the natural laws. So I would say that the basic definition of reason here is, first of all, the definition of natural law from the Enlightenment, which means free enterprise. Or the very famous thing of Mill or Adam Smith. You all know about Adam Smith. Adam Smith's famous secret hand, which is the secret hand of God. If you leave free enterprise alone, the natural law will work to make everything come out in harmony and reason, yes? So the secret hand of Adam Smith, you all know about, that's one kind of reason. But the other definition of reason is, I think, liberalism itself. That is constitutionalism, respectability, free enterprise, that all of these things are reasonable because the vocabulary of reason, as I said, becomes, in a sense, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Reasonably is, in a sense, what I think is reasonable. Now, to summarize this a little bit. I would say, therefore, that as far as liberalism is concerned, its great problem was to find a common definition. Now, that's much easier, of course, for theories based on religion. You have a common religious definition. You have something that is fairly well defined and dense, like pietism or evangelism. You know what the truth is, yes? Now, the Enlightenment quested for truth, and it knew what the truth was in the natural laws. And in a sense, liberalism kept that truth, but it added to that truth the problem of a linear progress and of individualism. And so it had to search for a truth in order to recapture a harmony. And the way it did it is, I think I have described it clearly enough with these kind of pillars that I have just mentioned. Now, why, may you say, is it so important, this idea of harmony? It is always ever more important in the new age, because you must never forget the speed of time. You must never forget the industrialization. And so liberalism is concerned, as Hegel was, with the end of alienation, as all these theories are, coping with this rapid change, with the isolation of the individual. And liberalism here had a problem, of course, quite clearly. It had two great anxieties, which are clear in de Tocqueville, very clear. Clearer, perhaps, than in Mill. The anxiety about the individual in a rapidly changing world. What are you going to do in the individual in the railway age? when the landscape even changes. Even nature is no longer fixed. Nothing is fixed anymore, yes? Nothing is fixed anymore. You have no longer a landscape. Nature vanishes. That's very serious. You never think about it. You're so used to nature vanishing. You're so used to that speed that you never think. First it vanishes with the railroad, and from the airplane you never see nature. And in a few months I'm going to take my first Concorde, then I don't see nature at all. So anyway, you don't see nature. So what does that do to you, yes? It completely disorients you. It completely disorients you because you have nothing to grasp. I personally, of course, love it, being disoriented that way. But anyway, it makes an anxiety. Anxiety. But I have no anxiety about capitalism because it doesn't affect me one way or another. So I have a kind of anxiety. And the second anxiety is, of course, the anxiety that any new movement feels about getting rid of the old, not going too far. You defeat the ancien regime, but you still want the state. But what kind of a state? You don't want to go far. Any new movement has that idea. You don't want to go far. You don't want to slide off into chaos. Always a problem for a new movement. Now it is clear that for Karl Marx, the theory of alienation was seen in terms of a theory of labor in the fashion of Hegel and the early socialists. For liberalism, alienation was not seen as a theory of labor. Marx was thought, and Hegel thought, that man was alienated from his product and at the same time alienated from himself. As Karl Marx put it, communism is the positive abolition of private property, of human self-alienation, and thus the real appropriation of human nature through man. Now, Hegel never went so far in abolishing the division of labor by saying you can only do that by abolishing private property, that is the only way you recapture your own human nature. But both of them thought in alienation in the terms of the division of labor. Both of them thought, in other words, in terms of the early industrial revolution, in the division of labor. That is clear. But typically enough, Tocqueville did not. When he writes about the same problem, alienation means what? Alienation means the breakdown of self-governing society, of local government, of self-governing society. So alienation here is defined in political terms, in rather, I should think, narrow political terms. Self-alienation is the breakdown of participation in the state. And participation in the state is through local government up. So for Tocqueville and the liberals, alienation has nothing to do with the division of labor, but it is a political definition, a definition of the state, a collapse of self-government. Not property, therefore, is what matters. But as de Tocqueville put it, what matters is the spirit of government. Now, here we come to something that can summarize all I've been trying to say today. That for liberalism, the spirit of government was all important. And the spirit of government is made by individuals involving themselves in government, first on the local level and then on the national level, if you like, involving themselves in government, the idea that I stressed so much last time, voluntary service, based on the British example of the Justice of the Peace, to which I can't go into, but Britain had a long tradition of voluntary, if you like, public service through the Justice of the Peace, a certain extent through the sheriff, a long tradition, but you have the tradition of voluntary service. Now, the importance is, again, this kind of spirit of government. And this kind of spirit of government is produced by individuals. So in the last resort on liberalism, it comes down to the individual. What is the spirit of government? It is the spirit of reasonable individuals. And I come back again, therefore, to reason. And because of it, that it must be of educated individuals. Therefore, to have the spirit of government, you have to have education. You have to have reason. And it is a spirit of government which depends, again, on the others, on respect for the Constitution, and on respectability. It all comes together. In other words, when liberals say the spirit of government or the spirit of public service, they subsume a commitment to constitutions, opposition to the ancien regime, but also opposition to the lower classes, to the mob, of course. Opposition to the mob, opposition to the ancien regime, yes? Commitment to the constitution, commitment to respectability, and commitment to reason. In the definition, I have said that. So that the spirit of government is really the spirit here of a kind of middle-class self-consciousness, a kind of middle-class self-consciousness, which does not, of course, exclude equality. Tocqueville believed in coming equality. That was ordained by Providence. But again, the coming equality comes through educating people up to this kind of equality, to the level of equality. And you do that, as it were, through the property franchise, and you do that through a system of education, which you will read about to Tom Brown, and to which I will come. Through both of these methods, in a way, you make sure that reason prevails. It is very typical that somebody like de Tocqueville had very little sense of economics, no sense about economics at all. It's very remarkable that in Tocqueville's writings you find very little about what was really going on when he discusses in English a movement like the Chartists and so on. It comes out very clearly. He had very little sense of economics. And his solution for the problem of the lower classes was, if you like, similarly naive. It was all based, in a word, on raising them up into the middle classes. It was all based upon, as he puts it, extending the circle of political rights, inasmuch as the lower classes are raised up. The solution to the problem of the lower classes is to absorb them into the middle classes. Into the middle classes. Which means, again, that they have to get property. Clearly. They have to get property, but they also have to get an education. You absorb them into the middle classes. And quite rightly, as I said before, it never occurred to any of these people that this couldn't be done. You are at an earlier stage of capitalist development when, as you will see, that was still really possible. And before you condemn liberalism, you must say that they did. They put that into practice. They put that into practice, not through savings schemes to helping the poor save, through all sorts of schemes, as we would say, of capital accumulation for the poor, and through all sorts of schemes of educating the poor. As you will see, They founded, as I said, adult education movements. It's founded, it's a liberal affair at first. Adult education movements, all of these things, keeping alive and indeed in a way deepening, if you like, deepening a great deal, this great faith on education. And this was the strength of liberalism. For in the last resort, liberalism was institutionalized through education rather than through anything else. You can say it was institutionalized through parliamentary government and constitutions. You would be right. But parliamentary government and institutions eventually will, after all, decline. Will go out of fashion, out of business. And yet the essential ideas of liberalism will remain even outside them. And they become so strong because they are institutionalized in education, in Tom Brown. Talk more about that. They are institutionalized in education. And therefore, they remain strong even when the other institutionalization, parliamentary government and political parties, go under. For after all, liberal attitudes are still with us, not only in America, but in all of the world. Partly because in a certain stage of economic endeavor, they really deliver the goods, this kind of discipline, with Samuel Smiles' self-help, and partly because they were institutionalized so powerfully. And to that, we must then come on Monday.